Military and FEMA personnel cordoned off every major city. Checkpoints were established on every interstate and major road. Air, rail, and bus traffic ceased. Anyone outside a cordon zone would be directed to a series of shelters set up in rural areas at schools, sports arenas, and courthouses. The federal government also temporarily nationalized every company in key industries: telecommunications, internet hosting, shipping and logistics, power and energy, and healthcare. Around 2 p.m., school buses arrived on Elliott Street. Anyone with symptoms of the X1 virus was instructed to get on. It was a bizarre scene. A convoy of buses loading up, coughing adults, teens, and children on a Sunday. In his address, the president had warned that anyone who didn't get on the bus would not be registered for essential services. In the coming days, the National Guard and military would be distributing food and transporting sick individuals to care centers. Anyone who refused to register would be denied food and medical care. And more, they'd be detained and placed in a low-priority quarantine zone, a prison with only basic services. It could be a death sentence. Elliot stood at the front door, peering through the glass. The half-empty bus stopped outside their home, and the door swung open. At his side, Rose held his arm. She whispered, keeping her voice too quiet for their son and grandson to hear.
I don't want to go.
We have to, darling. Elliot turned to his son, who stood a safe distance away. He tried to sound casual, as if they were just going out for a movie.
We should be back in a few hours.
Ryan didn't buy it. Don't go.
They're just trying to get a head count. They need to figure out what they're dealing with. We'll be right back.
Standing in line to get on the bus, Elliot could smell the chlorine wafting through its open doors. He made eye contact with several of his neighbors, those he had enlisted in his plan. Their expressions said, "You were right." He was sorry that he was. The bus driver stood at the top of the stairs yelling for everyone to bring their cell phones with them, that if they didn't bring their phones, they might not be able to get medical care and food in the future. Several people broke from the line and ran home for their phones. The seats were still damp from the germ-killing chemical mix applied to them, but Elliot and Rose sat anyway. They put his arm around her, trying to keep her warm in the late November chill. The roads were empty. The bus joined a convoy of other buses that barreled through Atlanta, past parked cars and empty sidewalks, where bits of trash tumbled in the wind. Parked police cars with flashing lights blocked them from taking any other route. Police in riot gear lined the streets, yelling and pointing at anyone on foot. It was a bizarre tour of a city on lockdown, a city that a few hours ago had been free, and was now something very different. After a few turns, Elliot knew where they were headed. The FEMA tents outside the Georgia Dome confirmed his suspicion. The facility, home to the Atlanta Falcons football team, had been the largest domed stadium in the world when it first opened in 1992. It still ranked third. It was also, however, no longer state-of-the-art. For that reason alone, the city was erecting a shiny new high-tech stadium right across the street, aptly dubbed the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. It was due to open in the next year. Elliot would have expected the towering cranes to be still on a Sunday afternoon, but they were working feverishly, hoisting up parts of the stadium's retractable roof. It appeared they were trying to finish it, and quickly. In so many ways, downtown Atlanta was the perfect place to conduct a quarantine. With Phillips Arena across the street, the authorities had three large stadiums in which to separate the population. Elliot imagined FEMA tents covering Centennial Olympic Park nearby, operations stations and administrative quarters set up in the Omni Hotel, and a command center at the CNN Center. The massive covered parking decks in the area were perfect for staging supplies. And if it was needed, the Georgia World Congress Center, the third largest convention center in the U.S., with nearly 4 million square feet of floor space, was also near, as were the Georgia Aquarium and the College Football Hall of Fame. Ahead, a figure wearing a positive pressure personnel suit, or space suit, stood outside a FEMA tent directing traffic. It was unnerving to see someone wearing the suit in downtown Atlanta. The line moved slowly, the buses ahead releasing their passengers in waves that flowed out until they were empty. When Elliot and Rose's bus came to a stop, along with six others, seven suited figures emerged from the tent and entered the buses. The man who entered Elliot's bus wore army fatigues under his suit. Elliot could see the top of his uniform inside the helmet. In front of the FEMA tent, a man held up a red flag. The man at the front of the bus spoke via speaker, giving his voice an unnerving Darth Vader-like tone.
If you have been infected for 7 days or more, please raise your hand.
A few hands went up slowly. The suited man's eyes darted across the bus, seeming to mark the people in his mind. He squinted as if something was wrong.
Please, this is important. We need to know how long you've been infected to give you proper care. If you had a cough or were sneezing last Sunday, raise your hand now. This is very important.
That's odd, Elliot thought. A few more hands went up. From his peripheral vision, he saw Rose raise her hand. He was about to stop her, but the suited figure had already seen her hand go up. Outside, the man by the tent lowered the red flag, as if calling for the start of a race.
Okay. If your hand is raised, stand up and exit the bus. They'll direct you outside.
Elliot saw fear in Rose's eyes. The suited figure remained at the front of the bus, watching, making sure everyone who had raised their hand disembarked. Elliot stood in his seat.
Can you tell us?
Sir, please sit down. I just want to know, sir, your questions will be answered inside. If you don't sit back down, I'll have you removed and placed in quarantine.
Elliot sank back down into his seat. To Rose, the suited figure said,
Ma'am, please come forward.
She stared at Elliot. He gave her his bravest face.
It's okay, he whispered. Go ahead.
Outside the bus, the entire cohort was ushered into the Georgia Dome. When the last person cleared the FEMA tent, the figure outside raised a yellow flag. The suited soldier spoke again.
If you are over 60 years of age, or if you are unable to walk without assistance, please raise your hand.
Elliot was 63, and he didn't look especially young. His time at the CDC had been rough on his body, but he kept his hand down for her sake. The soldier eyed him with blatant suspicion. Elliot shrugged.
I've got a stressful job. It ages you.
The man shook his head, but let Elliot keep his seat. When the over 60 cohort had exited, the soldier left without another word. The suited figure outside held up a green flag, and to Elliot's surprise, the bus pulled away. His head turned, and he stared past the white FEMA tents and the suited individuals milling around. His eyes were fixed on the entrance to the Georgia Dome, where Rose had gone in, where he feared she might never come out. The bus stopped at a giant parking deck. The doors opened, and the driver yelled for everyone to get off. The passengers filed out, bewildered looks on their faces. A woman in a spacesuit directed everyone to take the stairwell to level 5. The people walked past her in silence, but inside the stairwell, whispers erupted, frightened voices asking questions.
Why 1 week? Are those people going to die? They're not going to let us go home. I knew it. We should run, now.
A booming voice from the landing above silenced the chorus.
Keep moving.
A suited man leaned over the rail, his muscular, unsmiling face ominous behind the helmet.
Keep moving. All your questions will be answered. Keep moving, people. Fall behind, you go to quarantine.
The horde surged forward after that, some pushing. On level 5, rows of booths were spread out. They reminded Elliot of voting booths on election day. Each was just big enough for one person and stood on flimsy legs.
Take a station, any station, spread out. You have 5 minutes to complete the questionnaire.
Inside a booth, Elliot found a tablet propped up, a large green start button glowing. He tapped it, and the screen showed a graphic with a cell phone and a prompt that said, Place your cell phone in the box to your right. The black box slid closed the moment Elliot dropped his phone inside. He heard the faint noise of electric motors. On the screen, a questionnaire appeared, many of the questions he had anticipated. It asked for his social security number, name, date of birth, home address, occupation, education, his current symptoms, when they began, his health history, especially any immunocompromising drugs or conditions, and his travel outside the country, especially to Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, Uganda, and Tanzania. Elliot lied about his date of birth. Some questions struck him as odd. Was he comfortable using a firearm? Had he ever been to prison? Had he ever been in the military or had military training? What does it mean? At the end of the questionnaire, a large thank you box appeared. The company logo below it was one he had never seen before. Rook Quantum Sciences. They must have developed the survey and database software the government was using. The black box opened, and he took out his cell phone. The screen was now black, except for the Rook Quantum Sciences logo. He tapped the home button. Two dialogues appeared. You have completed your questionnaire for the day. You have no new messages. So they had created an operating system for tracking the outbreak. That was smart. Around him, several suited figures were walking up and down the aisles. Occasionally, they paused at booths and spoke into their radios, calling for tech support. Got an incompatible cell phone at 1291. Need a tablet reboot on 1305. Seconds after Elliot stepped away from his booth, a suited figure wiped off the tablet he had used and directed him to the other side of the parking deck, where white curtains served as dividers between cubicles. Inside one small cubicle, a woman swabbed the inside of his cheeks and took two vials of blood, then placed the samples in a bag labeled Phaethon Genetics. She tore a label with a barcode off the sample bag and placed it on a bracelet, which she affixed to Elliot's right wrist. What's that for? Sequencing your genome will help us find a cure. She placed an identical bracelet on his other wrist. Don't take the ID bands off. You need them to get food rations and medical care. He nodded. My wife was taken... Sorry, sir. They'll answer your questions at the next station. This is important, okay? Your phone will issue an alert each day. It will ask you questions about your symptoms. Answer the questions honestly. Your life may depend on it. Keep your phone charged. He was about to ask a question when she raised her hand and yelled, Next! To Elliot, she said, Exit to your right, please. Ever since he had gotten off the bus, he had hoped to see someone he knew, a CDC official or Commissioned Corps officer. He hadn't, and his time was up. It turned out there was no next station. After the blood draw, they herded everyone into a stairwell on the opposite side of the parking deck and back onto the bus they had arrived on. They waited for it to fill back up. It never did. Many of the people who had gone into the parking deck with Elliot didn't return. The bus was less than half full when it pulled away. Elliot hoped it would return to the Georgia Dome. It didn't. It barreled down the road, retracing its route. Before he left home, he had instructed his son not to get on the next batch of buses, the buses that would pick up anyone without symptoms. Ryan was an anesthesiologist, and Elliot assumed he would be identified as someone with essential skills and would therefore be conscripted to help in the BioShield effort. But now everything had changed. He needed to make sure his son was on that bus, and that they kept him. Ryan might be their only chance of getting to Rose. He wondered how long he'd been gone. Had the buses for the well individuals already arrived? If so, that chance had already slipped away. On his street, he bounded off the bus and dashed inside his home, ignoring his neighbors calling his name, yelling questions about the outbreak. The house was quiet. The TV wasn't even on. He searched the first floor. Empty. The second. Empty. He pounded down the unpainted wooden stairs to the basement. Stopping in the damp space, he searched for the light. He clicked it on. Ryan, Sam, and Adam were seated on an old couch that Elliot had abandoned in the basement years ago. Adam was asleep in his mother's lap. Ryan looked up. Dad. Change of plans, Elliot said, panting. What? You need to get on the bus when it comes. Why? What happened? They have your mother in the Georgia Dome. Find her. Get her out of there. Chapter 57. Desmond had lost all sense of time. The only indicator of its passing was the growing trash pile that surrounded the Three Stooges, and even that was taken away when a janitor wheeled a cart in and cleaned the mess up. He maintained his exercise routine, pushing himself for more repetitions each time, cycling the exercises, careful not to overexert himself. His ribs still ached, but he was learning his limits and tender points. He was preparing. It was all he could do. Any break in the routine caught Desmond's attention, so when the tall blonde strode into the corridor beyond the cell again, he stopped in mid-push-up, turned, and watched. She stood before the three slobs, questioning them. The words that flowed from her mouth seemed to assault them like a swarm of bees. They shook their heads, threw up their hands, pointed at the screen, and argued back. Soon she was pointing too. Was she their boss? A messenger from their boss? Connor, Desmond presumed. Before she left, the blonde turned to him for the briefest of moments, with a look that carried some meaning he couldn't read, like a language he had once learned but had forgotten. And just as quickly, she was gone. Avery stood in Connor's stateroom giving a report. He held his hand up, stopping her.
Just tell me if they can make it happen.
They say it's like a needle in a haystack.
What about the apps being developed by the companies Des invested in?
They've tried them. If it's there, it's in some kind of back door. They say the memories could be tied to a location or released at a certain time. Hacking it might not even work if the release is hardwired. Connor looked up at the ceiling. What do you want to do? She asked.
We're running out of time. We have to try something new. Drastic.
Such as?
Such as I'll let you know, Avery.
She averted her eyes. More quietly, she said, Dr. Shaw is infected.
I'm aware of that.
With the Mandera strain, not the precursor flu virus.
I said I'm aware of that.
Should we administer the cure?
No. Leaving her infected gives us more control over her.
Day 9. 3,800,000,000 infected. 620,000 dead. Chapter 58. Desmond lay on the bed, giving his muscles a few minutes to rest. He contemplated what the most recent developments meant. The Three Stooges were gone. The folding table sat abandoned. Empty cans and food cartons lay where their computers had sat. Were they giving up on him? He hoped so. A crack shattered the silence, a seal breaking, rubber brushing past steel. The glass wall of his cell slid to the right into the bathroom wall. His cell was opening. Desmond rushed to the gap. His arm was through, then his torso. He wiggled, gaining inches each second. And then he was free, in the corridor, standing next to the card table. A closed hatch lay at the end of the corridor, and its wheel was turning. Someone's coming through. Desmond bounded toward it. The hatch opened. A handgun emerged. Then a skinny white arm. Desmond grabbed the wrist, snatched the gun away, and twisted the person's arm behind their back as he pushed through the hatch, the gun held out before him, sweeping the room, ready to fire. The assailant was a woman with blonde hair. He couldn't see her face, but he felt a hint of recognition. He focused, took in the scene. A long table with four flat screens and keyboards, computer towers below. Two uniformed soldiers on the ground, not moving. No blood. The woman's elbow connected with his injured ribs, sending a wave of blinding pain through him. He lost his grip on her. A knee slammed into his forearm, and he dropped the gun. She spun him around and kicked him hard in the chest. The impact with the wall knocked the wind out of him. Gasping for air, he slid down the wall, fighting not to pass out. She grabbed the gun, tucked it into a shoulder holster, and squatted down, her green, intense eyes level with his.
Hey, genius, I'm the one rescuing you. You want to fight me, or you want to get out of here?
Desmond glanced at the guards. They were out cold, but alive. Small darts protruded from their necks.
What's it going to be, Des? I'm leaving, with or without you.
He remembered her name then. Avery. The woman who had allowed him to hear her conversation with the programmers.
Can I trust her? What choice do I have?
How? He said, between shallow breaths. Avery grabbed a semi-automatic rifle and a backpack from the corner of the room. From the backpack, she drew out a pile of clothes and night vision goggles.
Put the uniform on. Hang on to the NVGs. Power goes out in 20 seconds. There's a Helo 7 decks above us. I figure we've got about 3 minutes to get there.
If we're not there by then, we'll have to shoot our way out.
Desmond felt cornered. Like the day Dale Epley had come to Orville's house. He had fought for his life that day, and he had killed for the first time. He made his decision. He would fight his way out if he had to. He was going to stop these people, even if it killed him. He took the clothes and began slipping them on. Movement on one of the flat screens caught Desmond's eye. They showed four cells just like his, three empty, one occupied. A woman, roughly his age, with dark hair. Her skin was the color and smoothness of porcelain.
"Peyton Shaw," he whispered.
So they had captured her, too. Her phone number had been the only clue he had left himself in Berlin. She had been investigating the outbreak in Kenya, the outbreak Connor had started, that the man swore Desmond had helped start. Somehow she was connected to what was happening. She might even be the key to stopping it. Desmond pointed to the screen. "We're taking her with us."
"No, no way!"
"Listen to me, Avery. She's coming with us." Avery exhaled. "She's coming with us." The blonde shook her head in frustration, but to Desmond's relief, she moved to the long table and typed on one of the computer keyboards. On the screen, the glass wall of Peyton's cell began sliding open, but it had slid only about 7 inches when the power went out. Chapter 59. Peyton stared in disbelief as the glass wall started opening. Were they moving her? Or coming to kill her? That was it. They had gotten her CDC password when they drugged her. Now they don't need me anymore. Fear rose inside her, but just as quickly, rage met it. The two emotions fought a battle as she watched the glass partition slide. Rage won. If she was going to die here, she was going to die on her feet, kicking and screaming and punching. She wouldn't let it be easy for them. The lights snapped out, plunging the cell into darkness and utter quiet, like a sensory deprivation tank. Peyton froze. A second of panic sparked. Is this their plan? To kill me in the dark? I need to move. Peyton put her hands out, found the glass wall, and shuffled over to the side where it had begun opening. It hadn't moved far before the power went out. She slid her left arm and leg through, but her body caught at her chest. She placed her palm against the outer glass and pushed, trying to squeeze through. The exertion only made her breathe harder. Her chest heaved, expanding. Pain radiated from where the thick glass divider met her bones. It was no use. She'd never make it through. A sound. Metal creaking, then the loud boom of a hatch opening. Two white lights beamed into the corridor, moving back and forth like dueling lighthouses searching the darkness. The lights stopped moving, fixing on her. Fear drove her then. She wiggled back into her cell, but there was nowhere to hide. Even the bathroom was too open. She would die in seconds. She was sure of it. Two guards ran the length of the corridor. Bright LED lights shone from their helmets. She held a hand up, blotting out the beams so she could see the attackers. The first guard was a white woman with straight blonde hair that spilled out of the helmet. Her face was slender, striking, her eyes intense. Night vision goggles sat atop the helmet. The second guard... Peyton stopped cold at the man's face. Desmond Hughes. Seeing him in person brought on a conflicting mix of emotions that paralyzed her. He moved to the opening. "Peyton, my name is Desmond Hughes. I call to warn you." He stared at her, not a hint of recognition on his face. What's going on here? Why is he acting like he doesn't know me? He had acted the same during the call before she learned of the outbreak, an outbreak he seemed to be connected to, according to Lucas Turner. His name had been scrawled on the barn wall in the cell. And now he was dressed as a guard, pretending he didn't know her. Why? Was it all part of some plan? Her instincts urged her to go along with him, to behave as though she didn't know him. She sensed that revealing any information to her captors would be bad for her.
"I remember. What do you want?"
"We're getting out of here. Thought you might want to come."
Peyton nodded toward the opening.
"I tried. I won't fit."
The blonde leaned her head back, throwing the beam from her helmet at the ceiling.
"We don't have time for this, Des!"
He turned his head, bathing her in white light. She squinted, stared back at him a moment, then glanced away, signaling defeat. Desmond moved the beam of light out of her eyes.
"Can we shoot it, Avery?"
he asked. The woman shook her head. He held his hand out to Peyton.
"Then I'll pull you through."
Peyton hesitated.
No way this was going to work.
But Desmond waved her forward, confidence in his face. "What do I have to lose?" She moved to the opening, and Desmond gripped her arm, one hand on her bicep, the other on her forearm.
"We have to go fast. It's the only way."
More quietly, he added.
"It's going to hurt."
She stared at him, trying to look brave.
"I know. Let's get it over with."
He planted his foot on the glass and leaned back, pulling. Peyton closed her eyes as the pain took over. Pain in her chest as the glass raked past her ribs. Pain at her armpit as Desmond pulled until she was sure he was ripping her arm off. And then she tumbled free and fell on top of Desmond. Her face connected with his, but he moved quickly, deflected the blow, and caught her before she hit the floor.
"You okay?"
"Yeah."
Every breath through her bruised chest brought pain. Avery led them away from the cell.
"We need to hurry!"
Footsteps sounded from beyond the hatch at the end of the corridor. Avery and Desmond quickly reached up to flip their night vision goggles down and switch off their helmet lights, leaving Peyton in darkness.
"Stay here,"
Desmond whispered, his voice close to her. On instinct, Peyton crouched, making herself a smaller target, and moved to the wall. With each passing second, her eyes adjusted. Through the slightly open hatch, she could see beams of light crisscrossing the room beyond. Her chest ached as her heart beat faster, knowing these people were searching for her, would likely shoot her on sight. Desmond and Avery rushed through the hatch. 5 soft pops followed. Silenced rifle reports. Avery's voice, barely over a whisper, called into the dark corridor.
"We're clear! Come on!"
Peyton moved forward and paused at the entryway. Desmond and Avery had switched on their helmet lights again. Beams from 3 more helmets pointed at the ceiling, wall, and floor, depending on how the fallen soldiers had landed. Blood flowed from head and chest wounds, slowly covering the floor, a blob with tendrils reaching toward her. The gunshots reminded her of Hannah, of the blood that had flowed from her wound in the back of the SUV in Kenya. Avery was crouched over a backpack in the corner. Her face was bathed in shadows, but Peyton could make it out. She saw no remorse there, just cold concentration.
She saw a woman who had taken lives before and who wasn't bothered by it.
Avery reached inside the backpack, drew out a cell phone, and began tapping its screen.
"What are you doing?"
Desmond asked, sounding alarmed.
"Backup plan," she mumbled. "I told you we should have been out of here by now. We're out of time. We need a diversion."
Explosions rocked the ship.
"What was that?"
Desmond asked.
"That was the sound of us getting 5 more minutes to get off the ship."
"How?"
"Hull breaches,"
Avery said.
"She's sinking."
She moved to another hatch.
"Shoot anything that moves, Des. Don't hesitate."
"Wait,"
Peyton said.
"They're holding my colleague, Hannah Watson."
Avery glanced at Desmond, silently saying, "Shut her up."
"Is she still alive?"
Peyton asked, looking from one to the other. Desmond looked to Avery, who said nothing.
"Is she?"
Peyton stepped closer to the blonde.
"I don't know, she's in the hospital wing."
So McLean hadn't followed through on his threat. They had finished the surgery. If the ship sank, they would leave her. Hannah would die for sure.
"We have to bring her with us,"
Peyton said.
"No way,"
Avery said quickly.
"Absolutely not. I'm not even sure if we can get out."
Peyton fixed Desmond with a look that said one word.
"Please."
He turned to Avery and stared.
"We're dead if we do this, Des. I mean it."
"Then we'll die trying. We're not leaving anyone behind."
Chapter 60 Desmond's heart pounded in his chest and in his ears, like the sound of a truck driving over train tracks. He gripped the rifle, trying to make himself ready. The night vision goggles bathed the cramped corridor in a green glow. Avery walked a step in front of him, to his right, giving him a clear shot if they encountered resistance. Peyton's hand was tucked inside his waistband. He pulled her behind him through the darkness. She occasionally bumped into him and whispered, "Sorry," when they came to a stop or changed direction. Boots pounded the floors above and below. Muffled voices echoed through the darkness like ghosts chanting, seeming to close in on them.
"What's happening?" Desmond asked.
"Chaos, insubordination,"
Avery said. He knew she had an earpiece in, tuned to the ship's wireless comms.
"Connor's ordered a search for us, but most everyone is rushing to the lifeboats and tenders."
That was a break. Maybe they had a chance. Avery crouched by a hatch. She raised her NVGs, so Desmond did the same.
"Inside," she said. "Stay along the perimeter. Move fast."
The hatch crept open. Light poured out. This section had power. A battery backup? Generator? Avery stepped through the hatch and broke right, moving quickly. But Desmond couldn't help but stop at the sight of the vast room. It was as long as a football field, and almost half as wide. The ceiling hung 30 feet above. Rows of cubicles wrapped in sheet plastic covered the floor, with soft yellow lights glowing inside, like Japanese lanterns floating on a concrete sea. Each cubicle held a hospital bed, most with a patient lying still. Quiet beeps chirped from within, an out-of-sync symphony of death echoing in the cavernous space. A cart with body bags stood in the central corridor, abandoned. Desmond had seen this place before. This was the place that had come to him in a memory. He had thought it was a warehouse then. Now he knew the truth. The ship was a floating hospital, a laboratory where they conducted experiments. The setup was brilliant. The subjects had utterly no chance of escape. They were probably loaded on and off in cargo containers. Had they gathered vulnerable subjects from around the world, used them up and discarded them? The idea was horrifying. Peyton stood beside him, staring in shock. Two barely audible clicks from his right drew Desmond's attention. Avery was motioning to him, her expression saying, "Come on, you idiot!" He seemed to be able to read her perfectly, and she him. He wondered how long he had known her, and how he had known her. He caught up to her and grabbed her shoulder.
"Is there a cure on the ship?"
he whispered.
"What? To the outbreak in Africa?"
Avery seemed annoyed.
"No, Des. You don't remember?"
He stared, confused.
"They're testing something else here. It's..."
"Never mind. We have to hurry."
Testing something else?
Desmond wondered what that meant. He followed Avery around the outer row. At the far end of the room, she opened another hatch and burst through into a corridor, which was dimly lit with what Desmond assumed were emergency lights. The entire medical section apparently had its own backup power system. Plate glass windows along one wall revealed operating rooms in disarray. Blood covered the tables and dripped onto the floor. Bloody sutures, clamps, forceps, and scalpels lay strewn about. The opposite wall was solid except for a series of doors. Avery moved quickly, opening each one, her rifle held ready. Desmond covered her advance, sweeping his rifle forward and backward. Peyton tucked behind him.
"Found her,"
Avery called. Peyton rushed into the room. Hannah lay in a hospital bed, her eyes closed, her strawberry blonde hair spilling onto the white pillow. An IV line was connected to her hand, and a clear plastic bag hung beside her. A monitor displayed her vitals. Peyton lifted the young woman's eyelids.
"She's sedated."
She began disconnecting the IV.
"I'll carry her."
"You can't," Avery said, with force bordering on anger. Peyton stopped.
"I'm carrying her. We're going up 7 flights of stairs in a firefight. You can't carry that much dead weight."
"I'll..." Desmond began, but Avery flashed him a look.
"No, you won't. You've got to fight. The stairwell will be crawling with people. So will the deck."
Desmond knew there was no negotiation this time, and that Avery was right. To Peyton, Avery said,
"Either wake her up so she can walk out or leave her here. Your call."
Peyton glanced at Desmond. He nodded, silently insisting,
"Make the call."
Peyton studied the monitor a moment, then checked the end of the bed and began searching the drawers.
"What are you looking for?"
Avery asked.
"A chart. I need to know what they've given her and what dose." "The charts are electronic,"
Avery said. She gripped Peyton by the shoulders.
"Look, if you're going to wake her up, you've got to do it right now, okay?"
Peyton exhaled heavily. Her hands and eyes were steady, betraying no hint that she was nervous. But Desmond could sense her fear. It was as though he knew her well, could read the emotions she kept hidden, the feelings strangers couldn't see. Desmond wished he could take the weight off Peyton's shoulders, but he could only watch. Her next actions could save Hannah or end her life. If she brought Hannah out of sedation too quickly, it could be deadly. Peyton pulled out drawers, read labels on vials, and tossed them back one by one until she found what she needed. She loaded up a syringe and stuck it into the IV. Slowly, she depressed the plunger, watching Hannah. She kept one hand on the young woman's wrist, monitoring her pulse. Beyond the door, boots echoed in the corridor. Avery froze. Desmond turned. Hannah stirred, sucked in a breath, and let out a low moan. The footsteps stopped. Avery moved to the corner of the room, behind the door, and motioned for Desmond to join her. Peyton ducked down behind the bed. Desmond heard men's voices in the corridor speaking German. Something about gathering the samples. Hannah's eyes opened. They went wide at the sight of Desmond and Avery, dressed like her captors, guns at the ready. She opened her mouth to scream, but Peyton sprang up like a jack-in-the-box and covered the younger physician's mouth with her hand. Peyton held the other index finger to her own lips. The beeping of the pulse monitor was the only sound in the room. As the beeps got faster, Desmond felt his hands start to sweat. The footsteps outside resumed. They were moving away, except for a single set, which moved toward them. Avery motioned for Hannah to get off the bed. Peyton reached up, disconnected the IV, and pulled Hannah down beside her. Avery let her rifle slide out of her hands so that it hung by the shoulder strap. What's she doing? Desmond wondered. At that moment, the leads connected to the monitor slipped off Hannah. The beeping machine changed to a droning flatline just as the door creaked wider and a semi-automatic rifle peeked through. Avery drew a fixed-blade black combat knife from a sheath on her leg. It was about 8 inches long with a rubber handle. As soon as the man's face cleared the door, she sprang up and stabbed the blade into the man's neck. He gurgled as she guided him to the floor, his eyes wide in disbelief. Avery had severed his windpipe and spine in one lethal, extremely precise blow. Desmond stood in awe of her skill and poise. With barely a sound, she pulled the man clear of the door and readied her rifle. The other footsteps continued moving away, their echo growing fainter by the second. Avery withdrew the blade from the man's neck with a sickening, sucking sound, wiped it on his chest, and resheathed it. Still crouched, she moved deeper into the room and whispered to Peyton and Hannah.
"Let's move." To Desmond, she said. "I'll lead. They follow. You bring up the rear. Keep them moving."
Avery was through the door a second later. Peyton wrapped Hannah's good arm over her shoulder and pulled her up. Both women stared, mouths open at the sight of the dead man, but kept moving. Desmond stood guard while they raced down the corridor, following Avery to the stairwell, which was lit with emergency lights similar to those in the medical section. Avery stopped on the landing, listening. Voices echoed above and below, bouncing off the metal walls. Desmond didn't know if he was hearing 20 or 100 voices, only that there were too many for them to slip past, and certainly too many for them to fight. Avery set down her backpack, drew out a gas mask, and handed it to Desmond.
"Put this on. Stay here, then follow my lead."
She raced up the stairs, but no gas came. No shots were fired. He heard Avery's voice ring out, echoing through the stairwell with strength and authority.
"Corporal, I have the prisoners in my custody. I need your help securing them."
Chapter 61. Peyton's expression said what Desmond feared. She's betrayed us. He had harbored that fear ever since Avery had freed him from the cell. Whom did she work for? What was her agenda? Why had she freed them? More discussion above. Avery was arguing with another man now.
"These are McLean's orders. It's your funeral, gentlemen. Just stay out of the way."
More arguing. Then Avery leaned over the rail and yelled down,
Johnson, bring him up. She walked down a few stairs. Johnson, get your ass up here with those women. We're ready.
Desmond finally understood her plan. Her very brilliant plan. The look on Peyton's face told him that she did too. Still wearing the gas mask, he motioned for the two physicians to go ahead. In the patient room, Desmond had been quite worried about whether Hannah could make the trek up the stairs. He was now relieved to see her keeping pace with Peyton. Her legs seemed to get steadier with each step, the sedation wearing off, perhaps. At the landing above, two young soldiers wearing uniforms similar to Avery's and Desmond's stood waiting.
"Where's Hughes?" one asked.
"Hughes is dead," Avery said flatly.
Their eyes went wide.
"Get going or we will be too."
The two men took off up the stairs. Avery went after them, then the two women, and once more Desmond brought up the rear. One of the two soldiers was waiting for them at the next landing, pushing other soldiers and two civilians back to make a hole for them to pass.
"Stay back. McLean's orders," he barked.
The moment they cleared the landing, he took off up the stairs again, running past them. The second guard was standing on the next landing, running similar interference. It was working. They were going to make it out. The next flight of stairs passed without event, and the next. The crowds were growing thicker, though. The stairwell was clogged with people, civilians mostly, trying to get to the upper deck. Avery was increasing her pace. Desmond had urged Peyton and Hannah on. They trudged up the stairs, gripping the metal rails tightly, both women panting now. The bandage on Hannah's shoulder oozed blood. Tears streamed down her cheeks as she tried but failed to pull in a deep breath that Desmond knew must have been agonizing. As they approached the next landing, a tall man entering the stairwell yelled,
"Avery, stop where you are!"
She pointed at him and shouted back,
"Traitor! Mutineer!"
The uniformed guards around him looked confused for a moment. The man raised his gun, but Avery was quicker. Her shot caught him center mass, right in the chest, propelling him back into the crowd, which scattered. People shouted and ran out into the corridor or up the stairs, except for four soldiers, who must have been with the fallen man. They raised their rifles, ready to fire on Avery, but the corporal she'd enlisted stood in front of her, his own rifle raised at the four soldiers.
"Weapons down, right now," the corporal said. "She's lying to you," one of the other soldiers said. "She's breaking them out!"
The corporal hesitated, glanced back at Avery. It was a lethal mistake. One of the men shot him in his chest. He staggered back, went over the rail, and spun as he fell to the landing below. Avery's rifle erupted. Two soldiers dropped, then a third. The last man retreated out of the stairwell. Avery moved even faster now, pumping her legs. As she passed the bodies of the four fallen soldiers, she yelled up the stairs,
"Cover us, Sergeant!"
The sergeant peered over the railing from above. He looked hesitant, but nodded. The four of them barreled up the stairs, which were now empty. They were exposed. He quickened his pace. Avery reached the landing first. Sunlight poured through the open hatch. Freedom lay beyond the hatch. Or death, Desmond thought. They all hugged the wall, careful not to give anyone outside a shot at them.
"Good work, Sergeant," Avery said. "Take a position one flight down and cover our backs."
The man departed without a word. When he was out of sight, Avery unslung the backpack and drew out a round mirror with a long handle. She extended it into the hatchway just far enough to survey the scene outside. Whatever she saw, she didn't like. She pulled the mirror back and drew three grenades and two oblong objects from her pack.
"The helo's sitting on a pad at 10 o'clock. It's well guarded. They're loading the tender and lifeboats on the other side of the ship."
She paused, then looked at Desmond.
"This is going to get messy. I'm going to need your help."
Desmond knew what she was asking of him. When he spoke, his voice sounded more confident than he felt.
"I understand."
She tossed two of the grenades out. Then the two oblong objects. Explosions vibrated through the deck and sent a wave of heat through the cracked hatch.
"Let's go,"
Avery said, rushing out into the cloud of smoke. Peyton and Hannah followed close behind her, and Desmond brought up the rear. A firefight erupted instantly. Desmond could hear Avery firing, but he could see only her back, not her targets. The wind was whipping the smoke around like a twister on the prairie, unsure which way to go. A bullet whizzed past Desmond's head. He tried to follow the sound, but failed. There was chaos around him. Through breaks in the smoke, he saw throngs of people screaming, running to the tender and lifeboats, most wearing life vests. The wind swept the smoke aside for a moment, like a curtain being drawn, and Desmond saw the helicopter dead ahead. Avery had pulled away from Hannah and Peyton, who were moving as fast as they could. The last two guards beside the chopper fell as Avery fired. She climbed into the cockpit, and a few seconds later, Peyton hopped in and helped Hannah up. Desmond spun around, his back to the helicopter, covering them while the engines started. After what felt like an eternity, the rotors spun to life, their wind whipping at his back, dispersing the smoke, revealing carnage, wounded and dead soldiers. Desmond swallowed, knowing what might come next. The rifle stock rested against his shoulder, his finger around the trigger. He desperately wanted Avery to yell for him to get on. A figure burst through the hatchway from the stairwell. Desmond had a half second to scan him. Black body armor, rifle held at the ready. The man was blinded momentarily by the sunlight. Desmond squeezed the trigger. His first shot went wide. His second caught the man in the shoulder. His third killed him. Desmond waited, wondering, expecting a feeling that never came. He felt only cold focus as he held the weapon. Over the roar of the rotors, he heard Avery's call for him. The moment his foot hit the helicopter's rail, it lifted off. Peyton extended a hand, pulled him in. From the open door, he watched the sinking, smoking cargo ship as they flew away. Quickly, he took stock of Peyton. She was okay. He couldn't say the same for the younger woman. The exertion and increase in blood pressure had been disastrous for Hannah. Her wound oozed dark blood. Sweat drenched her. She was pale, too pale. Peyton leaned close to him. Her lips brushed his ear as she spoke, just loud enough for him to hear over the rotors.
Help me find a med kit, hurry! She's bleeding out!
Chapter 62. From a tender floating in the Indian Ocean, Connor watched the Kintaro Maru sink. With each second, the sea swallowed more of the smoking heap. Unlike the Beagle, it would never be found. He was sure of that.
Hughes had help, the captain muttered.
Brilliant deduction,
Connor muttered.
Should we? I'll handle it. I have this well in hand.
Desmond had helped as best he could while Peyton sewed Hannah's shoulder wound closed. She had operated with focus and poise, not a single second wasted. Desmond had no doubt that she had just saved the young woman's life. Hannah was extremely pale now, her face gaunt. Blood covered the floor of the helicopter. Gauze and boxes of medical supplies lay strewn about like volcanic islands rising from a blood-red sea. Peyton sank back to her haunches. She exhaled deeply, and every bit of energy seemed to flow out of her. Desmond half expected her to pass out herself. It must have been incredibly stressful, holding a friend and colleague's life in her hands, knowing every move she made could end the woman's life. She looked at Desmond with what he thought was skepticism. Then she leaned close to him, her lips inches from his ear, her words impossible for Avery to hear in the pilot's seat.
What's going on here, Des?
The tone was different from her words on the ship. It was somehow more tender, familiar.
What do you mean?
Why are you acting like you don't know me?
His eyes went wide. It was true. They did know each other. Quickly, he told her about waking up in Berlin with no memory of how he'd gotten there.
We need to talk, she said. There's something you need to know, but first...
She glanced around, found the headset hanging from the ceiling, and pulled it on. Desmond grabbed another headset.
Avery? Peyton's voice was once again firm, commanding almost. Hannah needs a hospital. She's lost too much blood.
Avery glanced back at her. Desmond sensed another Peyton-Avery argument coming on. Hoping to avoid it, he asked Avery where they were.
Off the coast of Kenya, near the border with Tanzania,
What's the plan? Call for help, she said simply. Desmond sensed that she didn't want to elaborate, perhaps because her most recent plans had been so thoroughly questioned and amended by her passengers.
Where are we headed?
Peyton asked.
Mombasa.
Peyton squinted.
There's no American embassy in Mombasa, or even a consulate. It was in my CDC briefing. In fact, no Western nations have embassies or consulates in the city. It's too dangerous. They all pulled out years ago.
A pause. Then Avery said,
At the bus depot, there's a locker with a field kit in it.
How does that help us? Desmond asked.
There's a sat phone inside. I'll call my handler. He'll arrange exfil.
Her handler, Desmond thought. On Peyton's face, he saw scrutiny. She didn't trust the other woman.
You didn't bring a sat phone with you?
Peyton asked.
I couldn't get my hands on one,
Avery said.
We were under a comm blackout on the ship,
she motioned to Desmond.
You saw the high security around even using a cell phone. They were under lock and key. Plus, they could have tracked any sat phone I took off the ship.
So assuming we get to the locker and make contact, how do we get out of Mombasa? Desmond asked.
There's a Kenyan naval base and a large airport. There are also several good hospitals, Peyton said. The Aga Khan Hospital would be my first choice.
Avery shook her head.
Look, I disabled the Kentaro Maru's other helo, but Connor McLean is very smart, and he knows we have an injured person on board. By now I'll have hired every crooked cop, mercenary, and bounty hunter in Mombasa and every other coastal town to try and find us. And the first places they'll stake out will be the hospitals and airports.
Peyton was about to launch a rebuttal when smoke on the horizon caught their attention. Mombasa was burning. Chapter 63. The smoke cloud over Mombasa was so thick they couldn't see the city. But after a few minutes of debate, Desmond, Peyton, and Avery agreed that it was still their best hope of reaching help and getting out of Kenya. Desmond sat back against the helicopter's rear wall and closed his eyes. The sight of the city on the coast reminded him of another place, what seemed like another life to him. And somehow, it also reminded him of Peyton, though the memory of her was just a feeling. He sensed that seeing her, touching her on the helicopter and during the escape, had been a sort of key to unlocking another memory. The night Desmond disposed of Dale Epley's body outside Slaughterville, Oklahoma, he thought hard about where he would go. He considered three places, Seattle, New York, and Silicon Valley. Thanks to countless IRC chat sessions, he had met people like himself from around the country and the world. But they were mostly concentrated in Silicon Valley, in cities like Menlo Park, Palo Alto, Mountain View, and Sunnyvale. He couldn't wait to get there and start over. He drove all day and camped every night. He obeyed the speed limit and avoided hotels. He didn't want to leave a paper trail in case anyone from Oklahoma came looking for him. Thanks to the bounty he'd found in Orville's safe, money wasn't a problem. It was morning when he drove past Fremont and Newark, onto the Dumbarton Bridge and over the San Francisco Bay, arriving in East Palo Alto. He found a small RV park off Bayshore Freeway, where he asked around to see if there was anything for sale. A few hours later, he was haggling over a well-used Airstream trailer with a bearded old man who was chewing tobacco and listening to talk radio. The man claimed he was in poor health and was headed, in his words, to the glue factory pretty soon. You'd rob a man on his deathbed? When Desmond finally got the price down to the high side of fare, he placed the $100 bills into the man's hand. Slowly, one at a time, at the man's request, so he could count them out loud. The old man wished him luck and told him to take good care of the trailer. Then he walked across the street and moved in with another resident, a woman who Desmond later learned the old man was romantically involved with. Desmond hitched the Airstream trailer to his truck and towed it to the tiny site he'd rented. Then he shaved, cleaned himself up, and stocked up at a local grocery store. As soon as his computer was set up on the trailer's dining table, he connected to the internet and began chatting. Luckily, the RV park offered telephone service as part of its base services, and there were a number of local AOL dial-in numbers available. Within the hour, he had three job interviews at promising web startups. The next morning, he worried a bit about his appearance. He was about to turn 19,
and had worked outdoors most of his life. The wind and sun on his face had aged him some, but not enough. He still looked like a teenager. He was also built like an NFL linebacker, not a computer hacker. He expected to look totally out of place, and to possibly get rejected on sight. To compensate, he bought a dark suit, a white button-up dress shirt, and a tie. The clerk at Macy's tied it for him. He even bought a pair of dress shoes, which felt weird to him after a life spent in steel-toed boots. Shaved, showered, shampooed, and dressed in the crisp suit, he thought he looked like a roughneck dressed up for prom. He was still nervous. He was also worried about his programming skills. He had been playing with all sorts of scripting languages on his free GeoCities page and a few other web hosts, but he wasn't completely sure what languages the startups would use. His concerns about his appearance vanished at the first interview. They barely looked at him. Everyone was wearing T-shirts and Teva sandals. In a cramped conference room, the company's CTO, Neil Ellison, slapped down a few sheets of paper with a programming problem on it. It was in Perl, a language he knew. "If you don't know Perl, you can leave now." Desmond picked up the pencil and began scribbling. "Find me when you're done." Desmond didn't look up. 15 minutes later, he approached Ellison. "Problem? I'm finished." The man glanced at the page, started to discard it, then saw something that made him study it closer. Another programmer peeked over his shoulder. "It's wrong," he said dismissively. "No," Ellison said. "It's a better solution than ours." Ellison looked up. "What did you say your name was?" The next two interviews proceeded in a similar manner. Only the programming languages changed. Desmond solved problems in PHP, JavaScript, and Python. At the end of the day, he had 3 job offers in writing. His first choice was an offer from a promising startup called XTV, but he needed help. He didn't understand half of what was in the contract. He asked around about a good lawyer, and later that day he was sitting in the office of Wallace Sinclair, attorney at law. The office was nice, which made Desmond worry about the man's rates. The biggest disappointment with all the job offers was that he wouldn't automatically get stock in the company when he signed on. Instead, the companies had something called a vesting schedule. He would get the stock over time, as he stayed with the startup. And it wasn't even stock outright. He was granted options, which were contracts to purchase the stock at a set price. "How does that do me any good?" Desmond asked. "If the stock goes up, it does you a great deal of good," Wallace said. "Think about it. If you have an option to purchase the stock at $1 and the stock is trading for $15, your option is worth $14 per share." Desmond understood that. "Best of all, you don't have to pay tax on options when they're granted, assuming the strike price is near the stock value. They're worthless until the stock goes up and you exercise them." There was more to the contract. A non-disclosure and a non-compete. Wallace walked him through it all. "Sometimes we see clawback provisions or a buy-sell agreement," he said. "You don't have that here. This contract looks pretty good. I'd sign it." Desmond thanked the man and asked him to send him a bill. He wrote out his address at the RV park. Wallace studied the address and said, "Forget it, Desmond. Just keep me in mind if you start a company or have more substantial legal work." Desmond liked that. It meant the lawyer recognized his potential, was willing to bet that Desmond would one day be a bigger fish. He called XTV back that night and said he could start the next day if they provided more stock and a lower salary. He wanted just enough to live on. They agreed. Desmond found startup life to his liking. It was strangely similar to working on the rigs. Long hours, deadlines, stressed out people, keyed up on coffee and energy drinks, and wild parties at regular intervals. But where his and Orville's release had taken place in honky-tonk bars, strip clubs, and casinos, the startup parties were thrown at swanky restaurants and hotel ballrooms. Desmond couldn't imagine the cost. It was perhaps the only thing that worried him about the company. He wasn't the only one concerned. The guys in finance were constantly obsessing about their burn rate, the amount of money the company spent every month. The CEO, however, seemed completely unconcerned. At a hotel ballroom on a Friday night, their visionary founder stood before his employees and guests and announced that XTV had just registered its 1 millionth user. Cheers went up. He paced the stage, microphone in hand.
We're democratizing TV. With the video cameras we provide, our users can capture what viewers really want to see, real life, and they can upload that footage directly to the XTV website, where they earn money from it. The screen behind him began playing a montage of clips, all muted. We've got a farmer in South Dakota giving people a look at what that harsh life is like. A teen mom in Atlanta struggling to make ends meet. An artist in Brooklyn selling his paintings in the subway and coffee shops. A singer in Seattle. A fishing competition in Alabama. A drag strip in North Carolina. A firefighter in Chicago. This is real life. These are the stories we crave. As faster internet speeds become available, more viewers will flock to XTV and our groundbreaking content. Mark my words, one day cable will be gone, so will satellite. You'll walk into Circuit City and you'll buy a TV that's internet ready, and you'll be browsing XTV every night to see what's on. In a few years, we'll be bigger than Viacom and Time Warner combined. We are the future of TV. We enable real people to tell their stories. That is our mission. Desmond believed every word he said. They all did. Cheers went up again. The champagne flowed, and everyone seemed to be drunk except Desmond. A few months later, Desmond was invited to a Halloween party one of the programmers was throwing. He was tempted not to go, but the truth was he wanted to do something besides work and sleep for a change. He'd been told that there'd be some people from work there, but that it would mostly be college students and recent graduates, like the host. He considered two options. One, not dressing up, and two, going all out. Both had risks. He took the middle road. He donned the black suit he'd purchased for the job interview, and only worn once, and bought a $5 dark-haired wig. At Office Max, he purchased a plastic ID badge holder with a metal clip. On a sheet of printer paper, he wrote, FBI, and below it, Fox Mulder, Special Agent. It looked pretty homemade, but it would get the job done. The party was at a 3-bedroom 70s ranch home in Palo Alto that 4 programmers rented. The owners hadn't done a ton of updates, and the place still had a Brady Bunch vibe. Thick, worn carpet, which was orange, modern architecture, an open-plan layout with a vaulted ceiling, and large windows and sliding doors that led out to a pool that hadn't been cleaned since Marcia's graduation party. Desmond was glad he'd dressed up. Everyone was decked out. The partygoers hadn't spent a fortune on their ensembles, but it was clear that they had put a lot of time and effort into them. Star Wars and Star Trek characters were well represented. 3 sets of Princess Leia buns bobbed around the room. 2 Darth Vaders stalked around, looming over small groups silently, their shiny outfits made mostly of black plastic trash bags. There were a half dozen Luke Skywalkers. Data and Worf from Star Trek The Next Generation.